What do you do if your house is infested with a demon? That's just one of the many things we'll talk with Adam Bly about when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Adam Bly with us as we talk about exorcisms, demons, haunted houses as well. The U.S., let me ask you this, Adam, in terms of, you said Italy, of course, could have a lot, primarily because of where it is.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, where do we rank here?
Well, I think we have a good amount of activity. We also have a good amount of training going on. So I think we're seeing a lot of cases here because the U.S. bishops were moved to address this officially at their conference. So they must be seeing quite a bit in order to set aside something for so controversial that they know, you know, would get some press and probably would raise some eyebrows. So that tells me that there must be quite a bit going on here nationally. You know, I'm not privy to every case. I'm only privy to the cases that I might work on and the cases under the bishops that I've, you know, developed relationships with. So my guess would be is that things are pretty active here.
Has a possessed person, Adam, ever been possessed by two or more demons, not just one?
It's always a colony, George. It's never just one. Okay? So basically, a possession, you don't want to think about it in terms of, okay, this demon got in this person. You want to think about it that hell, as an organization, has the legal rights to use this body. And so once they get a lease on that apartment, they can swap in and out different spirits at any time, including during the exorcisms. And when we deal with those exorcisms, it's always a colony of demons. So you're always dealing with a group of lower level ones before you get to the middle management and then the higher level ones.
I've always heard that if somebody, for example, is inebriated, that they tend to let their guard down and they could get possessed that way. Is that the case?
It's not that simple. Possession is a very serious thing in God's eyes, it seems. And in order to give the rights, it's all very legalistic, George. In order for a demon to get the legal rights before God, to hold up a contract to God and say, I've got the right to take over this person now, they have to have secured from that person an explicit yes when that person knows what they're saying yes to. So it's not as simple as you know, lowering your guard or getting really drunk or whatnot. It's not that easy.
But you're saying there that people are basically agreeing to let the demon in.
Absolutely.
Is it indirect or is it direct?
No, when it comes to the possessions, you know, the full-blown possessions, it's direct. Yep. It's the people know what they're doing, and at that last moment when they say yes, they know what they're saying yes to. And, of course, I know the next question, George, is why on earth would anybody say yes to that?
And how do they say yes?
Well, they say yes to it because the devil comes to us when we're weak. So if a person's weakness is they really, really want something in life and they're willing to give up everything to get it. Okay, so maybe it's power, maybe it's money, maybe it's sex. Those are the three biggies that people always fall for. But he'll also come at other types of weakness. He'll come to the mother, the single mother with a number of kids that's about to lose her home, and he'll say, you'll be provided for financially, your kids will have a roof over their head, you know, you won't be on the street, but you have to give us yourself. And that's a real case, you know, that I dealt with. So the devil's not shy about taking advantage of us when we're down, and he's also very clever at offering us something. Sometimes when we're young and dumb and we're willing to sell out for something, he'll come and make that offer.
Well, then who's the one, Adam, who tries to rid the body of the demon? It obviously, it's not the individual who brought it in, right?
Well, it is, because at the beginning, they may not think it's going to be as bad as it turns out to be. Sometimes they'll make a deal and they'll get a number of years of regular life and even worldly success. But then the devil always turns on people. He'll also sometimes turn on people at the end of their lives. One of the types of cases we see is an older person approaching death, you know, quite old, that will come to the church and say, look, I'm a Satanist. You know, when I was 18, I committed my life to this. You know, I was full-blown. I was raised in it, did all this stuff. And then as they're approaching death, the devil turns on them and starts torturing them and letting them know what they're heading towards. And then they come to the church and they say, look, can you bail me out?
Indeed. So during a possession, is the person possessed 24/7 or, you know, 30%, 80%? Is there a moment where they actually become themselves again?
Yeah. Really, the demon, when they're possessed, it's more like having a backseat driver in your car most of the time. So the demon's there, they can hear them in their mind, they can feel them in their body, but it's not taking over all the time. But it's saying, look, I don't want you doing certain things, and I want you doing these other things. And if you don't obey me, I'm going to punish you, okay? And that's the situation the person's in most of the time. And our job is to force that demon to show itself and reveal itself completely, so that we can figure out what legal rights it has to be in that person, break those rights, and then cast it out.
How many different demons are there? Is it just a handful that keep going from person to person to person, or are we talking about thousands, millions of them?
You know, I think that we're talking about hundreds or thousands in terms of the foot soldiers, the lower level ones.
All right.
And when you get up into the higher ranking ones, you start hearing the same names all the time. So there's only so many, what you might call a general under Satan, right? So there might be four or five main big name demons that you can find their names in the Old Testament or the New Testament. And, you know, sometimes you meet Satan himself too. But basically, when you get to the higher ranks, there's only a few at that rank. You know, there's nine ranks of demons because there was nine ranks of angels. Some fell from each rank. So at the lower level of the pyramid, there's so many that you could plow through them, you know, for your whole lifetime and never meet the same one. But as you get up into middle management and upper management, you're going to be meeting the same creature over and over.
Do they ever want the host that they have occupied to die?
No, they don't, George, because well, they want them to suicide, but they don't want to kill us. You know, they don't want to kill their host, and they don't want to kill us. And why is that? It's because that's not a win for them. A win for them is when our soul is damned. The body, really, in the grand scheme of things, is not nearly as important as the ultimate, you know, disposition of our soul. And that's really what Satan's after. So killing us is just not a win. He would rather corrupt us, turn us, use us, and then have us kill ourselves.
If somebody does kill themselves, are they possessed or are they just screwed up or depressed or whatever?
Well, I think, of course, the vast majority of the unfortunate suicides that happen is just mental illness. And, you know, sometimes it's accidental drug overdoses and other things like this, of course. I think these, you know, really extreme spiritual problems are rare. Do evil spirits have a hand in it? I think so. Just like they have a hand in every time we fall to temptation, they have a hand in that, and they're allowed to tempt us. And so if they're allowed to tempt us to smaller sins, you know, infidelity or whatever it might be, if they're allowed to tempt us there, well, they're probably allowed to tempt us to suicide also. So I think they have a hand in it, but our free will, George, cannot be violated. So they can say, hey, it'd be a good idea if you do that, but they can't force us to do it. God doesn't allow that. Our free will is so important because it's really the crux of this life.
We literally can push and choose our own destiny, can't we?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Why are there artifacts used, objects used in exorcisms, the cross, holy water? What does that do?
Well, there's three things that you usually see. Like you said, the cross, the holy water, and the stole are the three that are used most commonly, and then sometimes relics from the saints. Now, that blessed cross is there because, one, it's a symbol, And it's a symbol and a reminder to the priest, to the demon, to the possessed person of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the cross and the victory of Jesus over hell. You know, Jesus said, I came to push back the kingdom of darkness. So it's the ultimate symbol of his victory. And also as a blessed sacramental of the church, it carries a blessing inherent in it that makes it painful to be in contact with the demon. So if you took a cross that wasn't blessed and put it on a possessed person, you wouldn't get nearly the reaction if it's blessed. Now, the holy water is the same thing. It's almost like a scourge or a whip. It really hurts them badly, and it's a way to basically compel them. You know, you have to be careful. You don't want to get in the mindset of torturing. You know, you don't want to become like them and relish, you know, hurting them. But the holy water, through the action of heaven and that blessing, is a scourge to that demon.
I mean, if you tossed holy water on the victim to get out the demon, for example, would that body, you know, scar? Would it be like, you know, we've seen in the movies where, you know, they start to flame up because of the holy water?
No, the body is not harmed itself. It's the spirit that's animating the body that feels that pain. Now, the body can do strange things during exorcisms, but it's not directly in response to the sacramentals. It's the action of the demon. So the body can become extremely hot, you know, as if they're running a temperature of 105 degrees or something where their skin's burning. Strange things can happen. I've seen bones dislocate spontaneously. The body can bend in ways it really shouldn't normally bend. You know, the head doesn't spin around like in the movies, but basically some pretty strange things do happen, but that's more the demon doing things and trying to disturb everybody and interrupt the exorcism.
And these guttural voices that we hear that we've been talking about, what if the person's faking it? Is that possible, Adam?
Well, sure. Somebody could fake this in order to get attention, you know, to become the center of attention in a family, maybe where they're being neglected, and if they have some psychological problems that make that seem like an okay thing to do. And that's partly why we're really careful and we require a lot of, you know, really thoughtful evaluations of people before anything's approved.
Let's talk a little bit about the infestations in the house being infested with some of these demons. Does that happen a lot?
Well, I don't think it happens a lot. I think human spirit hauntings are much more common. But the demonic infestations, I would say I see 10 or 15 of those cases for every one possession.
Oh, that's pretty good odds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're much more common than the possessions. You know, it goes infestation when they get rights to a place, then it goes to oppression where they start getting rights to affect a person, and then possession where they've actually taken over that person. And so it's a process, and you see more of the beginning of the process than the end.
How does this infestation occur? What happens?
Well, it's kind of like with the body. If hell gets rights, legal rights, to be present in that place, like think about a house blessing. A lot of people in various faiths have some version of blessing their home. And that's basically claiming the home for God and saying, you know, we want our home protected by goodness and God and light and however they understand God. Well, people can do the opposite of that. They have the free will choice. They can consecrate it to evil. And so they can basically give rights to hell to occupy that property. And once those rights are given, they don't give them up until they're cast out and it's basically claimed for God. So somebody might have done something in a place. 10 years later, a different family moves in, and there's all these problems because of what the previous owners had done.
This infestation can last how long?
Oh,
years?
Yeah, forever, until they're cast out, because these things don't age. You know, they're very patient. And this is a war, like, think of the Risk board, the game that we played as kids.
Yeah, that's right.
Once hell gets a little piece of territory, they're not going to give that up. They're going to hold that. They may only leave one placeholder spirit there to wait, but they're going to wait for the next people to move in to see if they can work on the next family.
I'm not even sure kids even play board games anymore, Adam. They really have. I mean, we did, but I'm not sure they do.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
How do the infestations truly occur, though? What happens? How do they let them in? And how do so many come in?
Well, I'll tell you, there's the most common one that I'm seeing in our generation right now is people doing paranormal investigating in their own homes and engaging in spirit communication in their own home, right. Doing EVPs, this type of thing that you've seen on TV. And because they're inviting random spirits to form a relationship with them in their home, they're tacitly giving that spirit permission to be in the house. And usually these things, they play nice in the beginning. They pretend to be your grandmother or your guardian angel. But 6 months or a year later, you start seeing its true colors. And that's where I'm seeing most of the infestations coming from.
Well, when these demons, hit the house, when they get involved, when they're, in closets, you name it. I mean, where are they in the house, by the way? I mean, are they everywhere?
Well, that's a tough question because these are spiritual beings. They're not physical beings. But think of them as having the rights to manifest in that house. So it really doesn't matter where they are in the house. It's that they have rights to manifest there. So you might see some indication as you bless the house, the last bit that you bless, they're going to make a stand there because it's the only piece of real estate in the house that hasn't yet been turned back to the good side of things. But, you might see a shadow move through the room and say, okay, well, it's right there where I see that shadow thing. But is it really? Probably not. That's probably more of just a visual illusion designed to frighten the person. We can't really say that they're really one place or another because they're purely spiritual beings.
Do you need a priest to clean the house?
Well, if it's a true demonic infestation, which, it doesn't happen all the time, I would say yes. If you're Catholic, you should have a priest come because it's probably going to require a house exorcism, and that's really not something you should mess with on your own.
A lot of people say, bring sage, sprinkle it around the house, do this, do that. And you think then that's a bad idea?
Well, the thing is, unless it's been blessed, unless a bit of the divine, unless a bit of God has been brought into that matter, whatever it is, whether it's the incense that we burn or the sage somebody wants to burn, unless you've brought God into that, it's just a plant. So, basically when I've run into situations, people say, well, we tried everything. We did this, we did this, we did this. We brought these three different people in and nothing worked. And I've heard that over and over. And I'm not bashing other people or other systems. It's just that tends to be, they tend to come to the church as a last resort, usually, and we help people from all different faiths. And there's no judgment or heavy-handedness about it. But that's generally what I hear, is that these other methods, it might calm down for a couple days, but it doesn't work in the long run.
Adam, a lot of states now are now requiring that if a house is sold or about ready to be listed, you must disclose that it's been haunted.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting?
It sure is. It sure is. I mean, so this is something that seems to be widespread. If people think that they are possessed, or if their houses are possessed, or their belongings are possessed, what do they do? What do you recommend?
Well, the most important thing to do is to stay calm and really rationally try to debunk it and look at the rational explanations for it, because the vast majority of situations people are in are not these demonic problems. These demonic problems are very rare compared to all the other things in life.
You walked away from a television show. I want to talk with you about that when we come right back. Adam Bly, our special guest. Next hour, we'll take your stories, your phone calls with him on Coast to Coast AM. You sure are. And Adam Bly, our special guest tonight, will take your phone calls with him next hour, perhaps even your stories, your hauntings, your possessions, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Adam Bly, with us. Adam, and I do appreciate spending time with us, but giving us this truly insightful, incredible information.
I appreciate the time, too.
Have you ever gotten to a point where you thought a demon was basically following you home? Has that ever happened?
Oh, sure. You know, they threaten us all the time. And in the first couple years of being involved in this work, there was a lot of manifestations at my home. They basically try to scare you away from being involved in this, and they'll test you for a little while. And that's pretty common, but it's not anything that crosses the line into physical harm. It's basically, again, parlor tricks to see if they can rattle you. So, yeah, there was more of that in the early years. At this point, no. I mean, sometimes you can feel that they're nearby, but they really don't do anything anymore.
Who gets possessed the most, adults or children?
Adults, because generally the only way a child is going to become possessed is if the parent who has spiritual authority over the child gives them over. And it's kind of the opposite of a baptism. And so we do see that, but it's much more rare. And generally, God seems to restrain it until the child comes of age and can start making choices on their own. So thankfully, you know, through the mercy of God, those are much more rare.
You had talked about the case of the child that was walking up a wall. Tell me a little bit more about that case.
Well, I wasn't directly involved in that case. I just read the stories like everybody else, though I do know a priest who's friends with the exorcist that handled it. But basically, it was a case in Indiana a couple weeks ago, and it wasn't like an acrobatic thing of running up a wall. The kid supposedly just slid backwards up the wall sideways and then jumped off the ceiling in front of, I believe, a psychologist and a social worker. And so it ended up in the official reports for their job, and that's why it ended up making national news.
And there was a police officer who was involved in this, and, you know, he thought for a moment that they were concocting this story. He's convinced. He said, I'll quote it, he said, "I'm a believer."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's basically what happens, George, is, you know, everybody is naturally skeptical, and that's healthy. That's reasonable. But once you actually start seeing these things with your own eyes, that's when you see, you know, it's a radical change for people to have these direct experiences. And so even though he's a cop and, you know, he's putting his reputation on the line, when it comes down to it, if you saw it, you saw it.
And they say that demons possessed a woman and her three children, ages 7, 9, and 12.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is what some of the witnesses say. The kids' eyes bulged, evil smiles crossed their faces, their voices deepened every time it happened. You can't teach or train a kid to do that if it's a hoax, can you?
Well, you know,
how do you bulge your eyes?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the voice, that one, it's hard to say because people can do stuff with their voice. But, you know, if you're walking up a wall or you're walking on a ceiling, I've heard of a case where there was a kid walking on a ceiling in a principal's office and basically standing up there. And so when you start seeing stuff like that, yeah, that's not something you can fake.
No, not at all. That's amazing. Now, this television show you were on, Paranormal State, you walked off. What happened? They didn't take you seriously or what?
Oh, no. It was that was at the very beginning, George, and I didn't know really what was going on with this whole phenomenon yet. I was a staff advisor to that group at Penn State, and I had gone on a couple cases and then seen that, wow, this is actually a spiritual problem, and it's very real. This needs to be addressed properly. And they had been in the works of getting this TV show going, you know, for the last 6 months. So as I was realizing that this is a spiritual problem, and I had very serious ethical issues with filming people suffering and putting it on TV to make money, I was saying, like, look, I'm not comfortable doing this now that I understand what's going on. And honestly, the only reason I did that pilot episode is that they promised me it would never air. And they said it would just be a pilot because I really had serious issues with particularly putting a child that was having suffering on TV, because that can really ruin a child's life. So that's basically, I had already said I'm done before that pilot was filmed. And I went the route of working with the church, and I've been there ever since.
So in a particular case, you try to get psychiatric help or assistance first. Does the person ever undergo hypnosis before the exorcism occurs?
No. Basically, what happens if you use hypnosis with a possessed person, basically what you get is the demon comes out immediately. You won't even get through the whole hypnotic induction. So by shutting down the conscious mind, basically the demon comes forward and interrupts it, and you would never actually finish the hypnosis. So it's not really it's not a useful thing to do.
Can you get to the adult better than the kid? Let's assume they're both possessed. Which one do you have the better chance with being able to get the demon out of them?
Well, I would say the child, because in my experience, God is extremely loving and protective of children. And so if a child is possessed, it was through the action of the parent who had authority over that child, you know, unless they're of age, let's say they're 13, 14, 15. But basically what I've seen is that God is very quick to intervene and respond to prayers centered around children, whether the child has the problem or whether it's an infestation in the house and there's young children living there. When we've prayed and said, you know, God, there's young children here. We want them to have a normal life and grow up healthy and normal and not have these horrible things going on around them. Would you please stop all this? And it dramatically stops. So I would say the children, it would be easier.
That also has to be the most heartbreaking, watching that happen to a child.
Yeah, very, very sad. And it's very sad to kind of imagine the circumstance or the family, you know, in which that happened, you know, and how far gone somebody has to be in the deception of the devil to give their children over to this, because, you know, the parents have to be so far gone that they actually think this is a good idea. And that's a very sad thing, and it's important to pray for those people.
Are we seeing more or less cases these days?
Well, I would say that we're seeing more, definitely in the last 5 to 10 years. There's been enough of a dramatic increase that at the level of the bishops and national training, there's been a big shift. When I started getting involved in this 10 years ago, there was no national training. There was the association over in Rome, but there really was no network, so to speak. In the country, there weren't many priests doing this, and they were isolated. And now we've seen a dramatic change, and that's in response to the number of cases. And then the other thing that happens, George, is that when you bring this ministry online in a particular city, the cases come out of the woodwork, because there's a lot of people out there that have been suffering for a long time, but they had no recourse to get help. And so once the help is available, it seems that God brings those people forward, and then we can get them the help, hopefully successfully.
It is amazing at the structure of these demons. They've been with us since the beginning of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the mastermind of the devil, no doubt, Lucifer. You think they'll ever just back off? Is there anything that could happen to just get them to stop 100%?
No, George, because they're doing their job. You know, as strange as that sounds, it's their job to tempt us.
And they're doing it well, aren't they?
But very much so, very much so. And it's our job to resist that. So, you know, they're doing what they're supposed to do, as strange as it sounds. And basically these unusual cases we're talking about is when it really goes too far. So, you know, and then God provides these ways of bailing the people out of it. But you're not going to see them back off completely. If anything, you're going to see them get more intensely active the further along history, you know, plays out.
If you could convince somebody at the church about exorcisms, what would you tell them, or are they doing it all right now?
If I could convince them what?
To do anything about exorcisms, to change something, is there anything that you'd recommend?
Well, You know, what I've been kind of devoting my life to is providing more training so that there's more priests, so that they're not feeling alone and isolated and overwhelmed. And basically, I would encourage the bishops to bring two priests at least in each diocese online with this ministry, because there's a number of bishops that haven't yet brought anybody online. And, you know, I'm not being critical, because it's really, we're just getting all this going in this generation. But I would encourage the bishops to allow these priests to get trained, you know, send them over to Rome to the meetings we have there, send them to a conference here, and get the help out there, because there are suffering people. And if there's suffering people in those dioceses that don't have recourse to help, you know, that's just a sad thing, and I think we should address it.
And Adam, is most of the training done in Rome?
Not necessarily, no. I think 10 years ago, you would say, yeah, you really have to go to Rome to get trained. But now we're kind of coming up on a critical mass of a number of priests that have been trained here in the States. We have a number of people that have, you know, 5 or 10 years under their belt now, and they're at the point where they could start mentoring other priests. So I think it's good to go to Rome, and there's a few different places to go there, and I can help priests get hooked up with those things. But I think we have a lot of resources now in this country, and it's good. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a real turn and quite a number of good trained priests here.
Well, you had mentioned 400 to 500 priests worldwide performing exorcism. What about just in this country?
You know, I don't know exactly, but my guess would be, in terms of, you know, qualified people that are doing this on a regular basis, my guess would be is it's in the ballpark of 25 to 40.
That seems like a pretty good number. Almost, you know, one for every two states.
Mm-hmm. And you know, those are people that are doing this on a regular basis. There's many more that we've started the training process. But really, George, it takes a number of years to feel like you really are on your feet with this ministry. Yeah. It's not something you learn quickly. You really have to be mentored in it.
Are they strategically located around this country?
To an extent, yes. Yes. And the bishops are very good about if they don't have an exorcist in a particular place and there's an obvious case, they're generally really good about reaching out to other bishops. And so they might send a priest over to help with that, or they might have the person go visit a different diocese. So, yeah, I think they're trying to be smart about that as best they can. And again, in 5 or 10 years, hopefully we'll have enough that we won't have to worry about that. We'll just have them everywhere.
Do you have to be Catholic in order to utilize a priest for an exorcism?
No. Actually, the exorcists, all the ones that I know, are very, very loving, caring people. Now, they can't function as an exorcist unless the bishop gives them the okay, so you can't just knock on their door and say, hey, do this.
Right.
But in my experience, I've seen many cases of non-Catholics, non-Christians, unbaptized people that have come to the bishops and asked for help, and the bishops have approved, you know, that help to be available to them.
So, in the case of the Indiana family, do we know if the Catholic Church is involved in that one yet?
Oh, yeah. There was a Catholic exorcist that already took care of it.
And he cleansed them?
Yes. Yeah, as far as I know, that case is over.
That is very, very. Do we know what the priest thought of that case?
He actually gave an interview. I think people can find a video interview with him about the case online. He seemed to say it was a pretty standard exorcism, the typical things that you see. Mm-hmm. The nice thing in that case is that it apparently ended really quickly. It must have been only a couple sessions, and it was over. So the possession probably hadn't been going on for very long. They got it before it really settled in.
And everybody involved clearly says there was no fraud involved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because nowadays, you know, how many tricksters are there out there?
Well, these days I think there's quite a bit, and you have to be on guard against that. But then you also have to really be on guard. There's a lot of people that sadly have mental illness or maybe dementia.
Yes.
Or maybe a hormone problem. that are really sincerely convinced that they're experiencing a demonic problem. And it can be hard to work with them because they're really resistant to hearing that it could be a treatable medical condition. And they're suffering, you know. Even if it's not a demonic problem, they're genuinely suffering. And so, you know, those cases are also really important, and it's important to get them the right kind of care.
Yet who are we to say that they're not possessed?
Well, that's why we have diagnostic tests that we do in order to detect that. And I don't want to give the details of those because then the people, one, might run out and think, oh, I'm qualified to go test for this. I'm going to go, you know, do these things on a person, and they might provoke something that they can't handle. And then the other thing is, you know, people might misuse that and try to trick somebody by, you know, looking for that test and faking it.
What has been for you the experience of a lifetime in terms of an exorcism that scared the living daylights out of you?
Well, you know, like I said at the beginning, George, strangely, I've never been afraid. And that's something that God just takes that fear away. Even, you know, in the face of really intense, dangerous stuff, you're just kind of placid and calm. And you just pray, and you stay focused on God. Now, that being said, there was a moment where it wasn't during an exorcism, but in the midst of another circumstance, I ended up having to sit in a little utility closet with a possessed person because the demon had started to manifest in a public setting, and we wanted to protect them from being seen by other people in the parish. And so we kind of shuffled them off along with their husband into this little utility closet because we didn't want them to have the embarrassment, you know, and that to affect the family. So we were kind of sitting in there hoping this we could quell this and calm it down so that we could get them out of the building and back home without causing scandal for them. Well, after like 20 minutes, the husband said, well, I've really got to get back to what I was, you know, doing. People are waiting on me. Just you stay here. And so for about 15 minutes, I was sitting, you know, alone in this tiny little cramped space with a fully possessed person with a demon, you know, using their body. And some of the things that happened in those 15 minutes were, they'll stay with me. So you're basically in this life, you do have some interesting moments.
Adam, you've gone public. It's the first time you've been on our program. What was the reason for you agreeing to this? I'm curious.
Well, George, I think two things for me are happening. One, I'm hitting about 10 years of being involved in this, and I'm feeling like I think God wants me to start teaching more, both the priests and the public. And then the second thing is my diocese asked me to give an interview to a local TV station a few weeks ago.
Okay. Because
they asked me to do that, I did it. And that's kind of led to a lot of other media interest.
I am glad you did, because you're going to be a regular on the program, Adam, whether you know it or not. We're going to come back in a moment. Final hour, we'll take phone calls with you next.